This is a Rabble Podcast Network show. New voices in your head. It's Radio Free Radio.
Welcome to Democracy North, a weekly independent news and culture hour here on Vancouver Co-op Radio, as well as at w2media.ca, on Rabble Podcast Network, and on iTunes. We are here broadcasting from the heart of Vancouver's downtown east side on unceded Coast Salish territories, broadcasting out across Canada and around the world, featuring the top interviews and headlines from this week's daily media morning show here in Vancouver Co-op Radio, CFRO 100.5 FM. On our show today, we're looking in-depth at issues around farming, some that are underreported, including the intersections of race and class with farmers' markets, the protection of farmland in encroaching development, as well as the young agrarians. We'll be hearing from Sarah Dent talking about youth who are entering farming as a viable livelihood. Kent Melenix will also be here to talk about the Sustainable Agriculture and Food Security Program. All these and more. First, we'll be back with our news headlines.
Every weekday from 7 to 8 a.m., Media Mornings brings you independent news and culture you won't hear anywhere else.
Daily headlines, interviews, countless local voices, and our Latin America report help you make sense of today's news from Coast Salish territories to global affairs.
Guests include David Suzuki.
Media become hostages of the corporate agenda, and thank God for the independent like you.
Indigenous activists like Pam Palmater.
This kind of radio show helps inform Indigenous and non-Indigenous people and hopefully inspire our Indigenous citizens to take action.
Social justice advocates like Maude Barlow.
We are continue to be America's gas tank, although now we want to be the gas tank for the world.
Artists like Kenny Starr.
The landscape of change is created by lots of different types of activists.
Ray Spoon.
Gender is limiting and affecting everyone.
And authors like Michael Parenti.
The state is at the service of these corporations.
So tune in to Media Mornings, weekdays 7 to 8 a.m.
and podcasting at w2media.ca.
We'll be back with our news headlines. In our top story this week, we go to the Ukraine, where dozens of people have been killed overnight this week as central Kiev erupted into a battleground over this week. Bands of protesters drove riot police back from Independence Square on Thursday overnight, taking control of a much larger swath of territory after their tent village in the square was burned down by riot police. As The Guardian reports, overnight, volleys of smoke and stun grenades continued days of gunfire ringing out throughout Kiev, and youth armed with axes, knives, and truncheons and corrugated iron shields advanced on police on a bridge behind the square. The bloodiest day of independent Ukraine's history left at least 25 dead, more than 200 injured. President Viktor Yanukovych said the political opposition leaders had crossed a line by not condemning the violent protests. He spoke of stark consequences for them if they did not distance themselves from violence. The crowds have occupied parts of Kiev for nearly 3 months with focus on Independence Square, a huge space in the center of the capital. Russia has urged the Ukrainian authorities to crack down on the protesters, while Russian state television has frequently referred to them as terrorists and insurgents. Al Jazeera has this report.
The police are retreating from the area of the square they took on Tuesday. They accused the protesters of attacking with guns after setting fire to a bus. Intensive fighting followed. Within minutes, Independence Square had turned into a war zone. Snipers were firing from high positions. The protesters determined not to lose ground, no matter how many casualties they took. And there were many. Here, a hotel inundated with injured people. Medics doing what they could under these conditions. In the square, the protest movement seemed more like a war machine, with columns of people marching with bags full of rocks.
Once again, the square is a battle zone. The truce had seemed tenuous from the outset here. Now the front line has moved, Everywhere you look, there are casualties.
That was Al Jazeera reporting. Meanwhile, in the Olympics, the International Olympic Committee has banned Ukrainian competitors at the Sochi Winter Games from wearing black armbands to commemorate the deaths of protesters in Kiev. The country's Olympic Association said in a statement it had asked the IOC if its competitors could mark, quote, the deep pain over the loss of fellow countrymen by wearing black armbands. But the IOC claims that it is independent politically and does not allow any kind of political speech except at press conferences. In other Olympics news, already under fire for their explicit racial profiling, Russia's Olympic security force, the Cossack Militia, attacked the Pussy Riot punk group with whips and removed members' trademark ski masks violently in the Olympic host city on Wednesday. Associated Press reports that the group had gathered downtown about 30 kilometers from where the Winter Olympics are being held. They ran out of a restaurant wearing brightly colored clothes and ski masks, but were immediately set upon by a dozen Cossacks who are used by police authorities to patrol the streets. The group tried to start performing, but a Cossack smashed their guitar, followed by whippings of the Pussy Riot members, who on the ground were continually whipped for about 5 minutes. One man who was following the group and supporting them was left with blood on his face, saying that he was pushed onto the ground. Police arrived and questioned witnesses, but no one was arrested. In federal Canadian news, Justin Trudeau's Liberals arrive in Montreal this week with a positive wind in their sails, according to a new poll which suggests the party has jumped to an 8-point lead over the governing Conservatives. The Globe and Mail reports that the latest survey comes from Ipsos Reid and CTV and shows support for the federal Liberals stands at around 37% of decided voters, a gain of 4% from early February and slightly higher than where the party stood in November. Support for the Conservatives, however, is unchanged at 29%, while the NDP has fallen 3 points down to 24%. Members of the Liberal Party are gathering in Montreal for a four-day policy convention starting on Thursday. The online survey of over 1,000 Canadians was conducted between February 14th and 18th, considered accurate within plus or minus 3.5 percentage points. Meanwhile, Finance Minister Jim Flaherty orchestrated a low-key budget this week, delivering it during the Winter Olympics, and essentially was a bridge document that finishes the government's push to balance the books and sets the stage for a pre-election budget in 2015 that will contain new spending and tax cuts. Asked about the budget, however, it appears public sentiment leans towards concern that Ottawa is overly focused on cutting costs. 4 in 10 Canadians said the budget, quote, focused too much on deficit reduction, compared to only 1 in 4 who thought the budget focused too much on spending. Now to Mexico, where Prime Minister Stephen Harper has put pipelines front and center. On Wednesday, he visited with TransCanada representatives at their offices in Mexico City to talk about the Keystone XL pipeline. The pipeline was a key to-do item for Harper and the two cabinet ministers that accompanied him, although he is unlikely to leave Mexico with any commitment from the U.S. President Obama, who's come under pressure from environmental groups to block the pipeline from Alberta's oil sands down to Texas. He will likely leave with an ally in Mexico, which has indicated it does not see Keystone as an economic threat. Harper arrived in Mexico to meet his North American counterparts for the so-called Three Amigos Summit, where trade, travel, and the economy are on the agenda. In federal court news, the Conservative government says it wants to hear from the public about how to rewrite the prostitution laws struck down by the Supreme Court last year. As Canadian Press reports, a month-long online consultation period on the Justice Canada website, justice.gc.ca, began on Monday and runs to March 17th. And in a December 20th ruling, the High Court unanimously struck down laws against street soliciting, living on the avails of prostitution, and keeping a brothel. The Supreme Court ruled the laws endangered sex workers and were violations of their constitutional guarantees to life, liberty, and the security of the person, including the fact that the previous laws had banned women from hiring bodyguards to protect them. The court gave the government 1 year to come up with new legislation before the current criminal code provisions lapse. In the meantime, several provinces have said they will not prosecute prostitution-related offenses, but NDP Justice critic Françoise Boivin has expressed deep skepticism of the government's track record and is asking why they are putting it before a public input session instead of developing laws based on the best policy advice. In Canada Post news, the big push to install community mailboxes and end home delivery by Canada Post in urban settings took a concrete step forward Thursday when it identified which cities would lose their home delivery first this fall. It identified Fort McMurray, Oakville, Ontario, and parts of Calgary, Ottawa, Winnipeg, and Halifax as the first locations that will be moving away from home delivery and towards community mailboxes. The 11 communities are the first affected by the nationwide phase-out of door-to-door delivery in the next 5 years. Scheduled to be enforced by this fall, it will affect almost 100,000 homes. But Canada Post has not explained so far how it will be able to squeeze enough super mailboxes into the already cluttered streets of densely populated areas. Halifax Councillor Steve Craig, who sits on the municipality's Accessibility Advisory Committee, echoed concerns expressed by many of the people groups representing people with disabilities, saying that Canada Post should ensure that locations are chosen with care and that regular maintenance, especially in winter, is undertaken. Concerns over seniors' access to the mail continues to be expressed. In Alberta, new federal research has confirmed that water from the vast oil sands tailing ponds is leaching into groundwater and seeping into the Athabasca River. According to the Toronto Star, previous studies using models have estimated the leakage at 6.5 million liters a day from one single pond, only one of hundreds of tailings ponds, that so far oil sands companies do not know how to dispose of the wastewater. The Environment Canada study used new technology to actually fingerprint the mix of groundwater chemicals in the area. It found the mix of chemicals from tailings is different from that naturally found in naturally occurring deposits of bitumen. That mix, which contains toxic chemicals, has been found in groundwater around mining operations, but so far not in areas away from development. Now, however, they've discovered it in the Athabasca River, and it may explain why First Nations surrounding the oil sands say that they have 30% higher rates of certain rare forms of cancer than other populations. Over to Quebec, where a construction boss whose brothers had allegedly been roughed up by union thugs slammed engineering firms on Thursday during the Quebec's Charbonneau corruption inquiry, saying that they were never held accountable for their mistakes. The Montreal Gazette reports that during his second day testifying before the province's Commission on Collusion and Corruption in the Construction Industry, Normand Pedneau said that 40 years on the job, he had never seen an engineering firm pay for its mistakes. On Wednesday, he recounted how 9 years ago, his two brothers were threatened at a work site on Quebec's North Shore. FDQ construction leaders were not happy that Pedneau had hired local workers and not the workers the union leaders wanted. Justice France Charbonneau suggested on Thursday that the way to stop the cycle of fear would have been to report such intimidation. In Ontario, progressive conservative leader Tim Hudak's plan to allow contracting out of more public services is an attack on organized labor, according to Premier Kathleen Wynne. As the Toronto Star reports, against the backdrop of possible spring election, the Tories on Wednesday proposed the province's soon-to-be-appointed financial accountability officer examine ways to privatize jobs currently done by unionized workers. Hudak said the new officer should look at areas managed done by union workers and ensure that we contract out where possible and make the best sense for taxpayer services. However, Tory MPP Doug Holliday tabled a private member's bill to end the union monopoly on government contracts as the party aggressively postures against organized labor. Holliday's bill will allow for eventual privatization of some government information, though nothing security related. But Ontario Public Services Employees Union President Warren Thomas, who was at Queen's Park on Wednesday, warned that the Conservatives' plan is a bad idea that wouldn't save money. Over to Winnipeg, where the family of a man who died during a 34-hour wait in a hospital emergency room is pulling out of the next part of an inquest into his death. Two Aboriginal groups have also withdrawn. According to the Canadian Press, the groups and families say they have lost confidence that the inquest will help fix what they say is systemic racism that played a role in the death of Brian Sinclair, a 45-year-old Aboriginal double amputee. The inquiry has heard he was a substance abuser who frequently visited the emergency room at Winnipeg Health Sciences Centre. He died of a treatable bladder infection while waiting for 34 hours in the emergency room in 2008. The inquest has heard that Sinclair spoke to a triage aide when he arrived, wheeled himself into the waiting room, but was allowed to languish there, vomiting several times as his condition deteriorated without ever being officially triaged or examined by any medical professional. Now to international news, where in Ecuador, the government has been revealed to be negotiating a secret $1 billion deal with a Chinese bank to drill for oil under an area that it promised would become the Yasuni National Park in the Amazon. The deal has outraged indigenous and environmental groups. Behind-the-scenes deal facilitates trades for the access to Chinese lending for Ecuadorian government projects. However, human rights groups are dismayed. Yasuni is one of the most biodiverse places in the world and home to many indigenous peoples who live in what Ecuador's constitution calls voluntary isolation. Over to Bangladesh, where safety experts hired by Western retailers have now begun inspecting clothing factories in the country. According to the British Morning Star, the inspections began on Tuesday, nearly a year after 1,129 garment workers died in a building collapse that brought attention to some of the clothing brands that were producing clothing there, including Canada's Joe Fresh and other major labels. Dozens of fire officers and structural engineers will inspect more than 1,500 plants and recommend safety improvements. The Western companies signed a legally binding agreement following accusations they had allowed shoddy safety standards in a country where textile workers are paid as little as $40 a month. Retailers have agreed to loan their contractors money to carry out upgrades, but many garment bosses are unhappy about what they described as unnecessary and costly improvements. Over to Egypt, where three Al Jazeera English journalists, including Canadian Mohamed Fahmy, are still in jail and have appeared in court alongside 20 Al Jazeera journalists accused of supporting Mohamed Morsi's Muslim Brotherhood. Also jailed were Australian ex-BBC reporter Peter Grest, local producer Bahar Mohamed, who have been detained since December 29th. Egyptian authorities have presented the Brotherhood as a terrorist group since elected President Mohamed Morsi's overthrow last July. They have also condemned journalists who give its members a voice or ask for their opinion. Similarly, one of the biggest strikes in Egypt has started this week in the state-owned spinning and weaving factory, and the government has accused it as well of supporting the Muslim Brotherhood. However, the union leader said that that could not be further from the truth. Over to Qatar, where a human rights body has said the reported deaths of nearly 500 Indian workers in the country over the last 2 years as it prepares for the World Cup hosting is horrendous. But Qatar says that the itself has responded, saying the numbers are normal within what they expected. Qatar has faced mounting criticism for human rights violations over the safety and working conditions of migrants working in the construction industry. 4,000 people are predicted to be killed based on the average standards for construction in the country. Al Jazeera reported that the Human Rights Watch has said that the death figure should not be dismissed, and the country has a horrendous safety record. Qatar has a kafala system, which means migrants are sponsored by individuals who then exert enormous control over their lives, leaving some workers trapped. And that is our news for this week. Thank you for listening to Democracy North. Our next interview, we're going to be hearing a little bit more about some of the less reported aspects of farming. We'll be hearing from Allison Aiken, author of Black, White, and Green, Farmers Markets, Race, and the Green Economy, about what the political and social dynamics of farmers markets are, who can afford products there, and what could change that. Well, you're listening to Democracy North on w2media.ca/thisweek, as well as on Rabble Podcast Network on iTunes and here on Vancouver Co-op Radio, CFRO 100.5 FM. Well, earlier last month, Jane Bowie did an in-depth series on some of the issues facing contemporary farming. And one of the people she interviewed was Allison Aiken, author of Black, White, and Green, Farmers Markets, Race, and the Green Economy. She spoke to her about some of the social and political dynamics that may prevent people from being able to afford farmers markets and what could be done to change that. Here is Jane Bowie interviewing Allison Aiken on our program.
Media Mornings has been looking at the future of farming over the past few weeks. Many look to local farmers markets as a key solution. And farmers markets are considered to be part of a green economy, considered environmentally friendly and socially responsible. However, what about their market approach to societal change? The contradictions that arise from the shift of political and social responsibility from citizens to consumers. Allison Alcon, an assistant professor and chair of sociology at the University of the Pacific, has explored this and more in her book, Black, White, and Green, Farmers Markets, Race, and the Green Economy. Good morning, Allison.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on the show.
It's great. So you're going to be talking today at noon, and that talk is going to be about an hour, and we only have, you know, about 15 minutes at the maximum. So I hope that those who are really interested in what you have to say, we'll go to the talk and we'll give the details of that later on. So I understand your talk is going to look at the emergent concept of food justice. So maybe to start off with, that might be a good place, explaining what you mean by food justice.
Sure. I think of food justice as examining the ways that inequalities kind of matter within the food system, within the production, the distribution, the consumption of food. So who has access to becoming farmers, access to land, the ability to grow food and be paid for the growing of their food, who makes money off the distribution of food, and who has access to be able to consume the kinds of food that they would desire to consume. In particular, these inequalities seem to play out in terms of race, class, gender, and national status.
Mm-hmm.
So you might see advantaged groups owning land, you know, being the majority of farmers, and also having more access to all the different kinds of food that they might want, whether it's, you know, whole foods and homegrown foods and locally grown and organic foods and gourmet foods and a variety of ethnic foods and all those kinds of things, while communities that are more oppressed in the U.S., it's mostly indigenous and African American and Latino communities and some Southeast Asian communities have much less, much mm-hmm. fewer options in terms of the kind of farming they're able to do when they want to do farming, and also in terms of the kind of foods that they have access to.
Mm-hmm. We've been looking at a lot of these issues from the producer side, looking at how difficult it is for young farmers to find farmland to work upon, and the loss of farmland and as the drive for development gobbles up farmland in the province, and in Vancouver. It's, you know, it's a very diverse city, like the Bay Area. My observation here is that farmers markets remain disproportionately white and full of produce and other products that large numbers of people that live here in Vancouver can't afford. I know that your research is based on the work that you've done looking at markets in the Bay Area. And what did that research tell you?
Really, what that research was, so I looked at two farmers markets in the Bay Area. One was predominantly white in a really kind of wealthy part of Berkeley. It's the farmers market that's down the street from Chez Panisse, which is a very kind of hoity-toity organic restaurant that was one of the first restaurants in the 70s to start kind of featuring organic food and telling mm-hmm. you who the farmers were on their menu. So it's that kind of very strong environmental credentials, entirely organic, you know, farmers who want to be in the market are evaluated based on their environmental credentials. And I compared that with a farmers market in West Oakland, which is a predominantly African-American, though becoming more mixed through gentrification even since I did the study, neighborhood. And that farmers market was particularly around inviting in African-American farmers, who in the United States there are very few of, in part due to the fact that the USDA, the United States Department of Agriculture, was horribly discriminatory. And so black farmers didn't get any of the loans and support that allowed multi-generational white farmers to stay in business.
Mm-hmm.
So it was about finding a couple of black farmers in California and inviting them into the neighborhood and trying to build a connection between black farmers and low-income African-American populations who didn't have any access to good food in the neighborhood. You know, it was what's classically considered a food desert, though that term is all contested these days. But basically, let's say that there were, you know, there was one grocery store in the area. It closed in the middle of my study, and it was kind of dirty and had, you know, and kind of not a place anybody would want to shop.
Mm-hmm.
And there were lots of liquor stores and fast food establishments, and some people shopped at those places, and more people kind of once in a while took multiple buses to get to grocery stores that were far away. And so the thinking in this farmer's market was that if we could invite in black farmers and build a connection to these African-American citizens, you know, folks who live in the neighborhood, then there'd be a market, you know, there'd be an income stream for the black farmers, and there'd be a source of fresh food for the local residents. And it was a kind of wonderful idea and a really nice place to be.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem, what I found was problematic and what eventually led to the closure of the market, is that there really wasn't enough financial kind of capital in the neighborhood to support the farmers market. You know, the folks, there were African Americans from all over Oakland who really loved it and came once in a while, and there were white, young white folks moving in through gentrification who came to the market, who loved the market and came once in a while. Mm-hmm. But for the most part, the folks it was designed to help, the low-income African American folks from West Oakland, didn't have the financial means to be able to shop at the market, even though it was cheaper than, you know, by far cheaper than the Berkeley market and cheaper than any other market in the area.
Mm-hmm.
It was still more expensive than buying canned goods at, you know, at a discount grocery store.
Yeah.
And, you know, since then, a dollar store has opened nearby, and that seems to do very well.
Yeah.
And so, you know, even though people in the neighborhood really liked the goals of the farmers market, they liked that it was about black pride, they liked that it was about getting healthy food, they recognized that health disparities were an issue and that their community had, like, really high rates of diabetes and heart disease and all those kinds of things. So they liked the goals of it. They liked the environmental goals. They liked the social justice goals. They saw it as a place of education for youth. But the fact that the real way to participate in this farmer's market was to be a consumer, and they couldn't afford to be consumers, so the market couldn't afford to continue. And what that told me, and then in the Berkeley market, issues of kind of social and environmental justice were secondary. So anything about food access got talked about some, but was always kind of second to the environmental concerns or the kind of foodie gourmetness of the market. And so really what this told me is that it's very difficult to do these social and environmental projects through a market-based mechanism. Right.
Mm-hmm.
If you have to pay to be able to come, then dealing with inequalities is going to be really difficult, because the people who need to be most empowered, the people who suffer from the social and environmental injustices, won't be able to afford to participate. And so it really showed me that, you know, when food movements tend to choose market-based responses to social problems, right?
Yeah.
The food system is toxic, so let's create a food system that's not, and buy and sell food that's healthier. And, like, in theory, that's a really great idea, and actually in practice, it's a really great idea, right? There's been, a huge growth in the amount of food that's available, and that's the way that food is being grown, but it's not making a change that people who don't have the extra money or haven't radically changed their lives to make that their priority can participate in.
Mm-hmm.
And I think to be able to really make a change in, say, the amount of pesticides being used in the country, right, or in the world, then these movements need to not just be niches, they need to be changing the way even industrial farming is done through policy campaigns and things like that,
mm-hmm.
rather than just creating a way for those who can afford it to make different kinds of choices. But that being said, I do think, you know, I'm not saying we should get rid of farmers markets.
No.
I love farmers markets. I spent years studying them. But I do think that we need to start seeing farmers markets and CSAs and community gardens and urban farms as ways to kind of build a power base to use to do this political work. And I'm not necessarily saying, you know, people are always like, oh, farmers are so busy you can't put anything else on farmers. And I think that's true. But I think some of us who are consumers at these markets and who love these markets and who get why what's going on in organic farming and local farming and urban farming and all that stuff is so important and so exciting need to start figuring out how to get political about it so that the benefits become more easily accessible.
And that was Allison Aiken, author of Black, White, and Green, Farmers Markets, Race, and the Green Economy, interviewed by Jane Bowie in our program on January 22nd. Well, as we continue our in-depth look at farming and some of the new trends in farming today, we'll be back with Sarah Dent to talk about young agrarians and the ways that younger generations are interacting with farming and even potentially making a living off of it. You're listening to Democracy North here on Vancouver Co-op Radio, CFRO 100.5 FM, online at w2media.ca/thisweek, and on the Rabble Podcast Network and on iTunes. I'm David Ball, your host for this week. Well, next on our in-depth look at today's farming, we're airing an interview with Sarah Dent. She's with the Young Agrarians, and she was interviewed by Jane Bowie in our program on January 13th.
Good morning, Sarah. How are you?
Things are well, Jane.
That's good. So can you tell us a bit about the Young Agrarians?
Well, basically, there's a really amazing young farmer movement going on. There's some young farmers here locally that were really excited about the Greenhorns movement down in the U.S., which is a national 5,000 plus strong young farmer movement there, and we wanted to get something to going for Canada that would reflect young farmers and the issues that are happening up here. So we got Young Agrarians going approximately 2 years ago.
Great. So I'm wondering, I have a sense that there's a real growing interest in farming. I feel a school trustee and in schools as we increase the amount of urban farming that we're going on in the schools. It's running into more and more students who seem to have an interest in farming for their future. Do you see that happening as well?
Yeah, I'm definitely biased. We have a running farm tour and potluck series that has happened around BC. We've done lots of events in the Lower Mainland, and I'm constantly encouraged by the people that come out. We always do really quick introduction circles, so we learn who's there, what they're working on, where they're farming. Mm-hmm. And it's mind-blowing when, 50, 60 people show up and everybody's working on some aspect of food security, whether they're farming full-time or whether they're doing edible education in a school. I think there's just a growing movement of people that are really care about food and where it comes from and whether it's environmentally and ethically sourced. And people are engaging at all different scales and levels. And
So we've been doing a bit of a series looking at the future of farming in BC, and one of the things that's come up both in our discussions with Kent Mullenix from Kwantlen University and Harold Steves, the Richmond City Councillor, was the obstacles to accessing farmland. And wondered if you could talk a little bit about that, what it's like for young farmers to try and get land to grow crops on.
I think this is quite a big conundrum. BC has the highest land values in Canada. Ontario is next. So for young people these days to purchase land, to be able to go to the bank and make a case and get a mortgage is quite challenging unless you're what they call a second career farmer and you've already amassed some capital. So for most new farmers that haven't done that, let alone the fact that it's expensive across the board for anybody to purchase property at this stage in the game. So a lot of new farmers are having to look at alternatives. How can they lease land? How can they license land? And then that comes with a whole other set of issues with it, whether the land that you're looking at, whether the landowner is educated about farming, how farmable is it, access to market. There's all sorts of considerations that go into finding the right piece of land, finding the right landowner to make an agreement with. And then in in the long term, it's how long can you be on that land and mm-hmm. will you actually see a return on investment? So mm-hmm. we put together something called the BC Land Access Guide. It's really so you want to farm and here's some information about getting onto land and creating agreements. Mm-hmm. And we did our first series of land linking workshops in November of 2013 where we brought together landowners and land seekers, and we put out the guide and we put out a couple lease and license templates that we've had legally updated, and we put in plain English sidebars. And really our whole role has been to act as like a facilitator around land access and help people build community around it. Sorry about that. And then give people some tools so that they can at least look at best practices out there and think through all the different issues that could potentially come up and try and make agreements with landowners that are going to serve both parties in the long term.
Mm-hmm. It seems like in a lot of ways, as you know, someone, I have family members that, extended family members that farm on the prairies, and it seems that the moving towards being a tenant farmer is, it seems to me to be a certain level of steps back, and to almost being like sharecroppers. Your thoughts on that?
I think most people these days are basically like spending cash for their leases and licenses. Mm-hmm. I think that there are maybe some people that are doing profit shares with the owners.
Mm-hmm.
But in general, people are just giving straight cash for, mm-hmm. for leases and licenses.
Mm-hmm.
Although I think sharecropping, could be a good idea as well, because it means that the farmer isn't on the line for cash. They can, up front, they can pay cash if they're made it, had a good season.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah, which in a startup is maybe a good idea, since startup is your hardest period of time when you get going. Yeah.
I wonder about if you don't have a sense of how long you're going to really be able to remain farming that land, how difficult it is to be able to say, become certified for organic farming.
Well, I think that's a big obstacle for people who aren't urban, is whether they've got tenure.
Mm-hmm.
So they're not going to certify organic if they don't have a longer-term capacity to be on the land.
Mm-hmm.
It's paperwork, it's money, it's a process. There's quite a few things that go into it.
Mm-hmm.
So, I would definitely think that land tenure is going to be an obstacle for people wanting to certify.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
We've actually gotten that feedback. We have a survey that we put out. We've only had 22 farmers so far reply to it, so we can't make any broad analysis from the data, but that was for people who weren't certified organic in the survey. It was because they didn't have tenure.
Mm-hmm. So
yeah.
If a young farmer can access some farmland at a somewhat livable level in terms of balancing what you're paying to access that land and what you're able to sell, what you grow at, can people make a living at it?
I think that there are a bunch of young farmers that are making a living.
Mm-hmm.
I think it depends on what you see making a living as.
Yeah, that's often the case.
Yeah, there's lots of new young farmers, brave young farmers, wonderful young farmers that are getting by, and they're giving it a go. There's some people that have family support, so they've got access to land because of their family, or they're working a family farm.
Mm-hmm.
And those farmers are generally further ahead,
mm-hmm.
In terms of what they're being able to make. That's a generalization I wouldn't take to the bank.
Yeah.
But I think new farmers are definitely facing a lot of challenges. I mean, most businesses, I can't remember what the statistic is, but just to start a regular business, there's a pretty high failure rate.
Mm-hmm.
And then if you factor in farming, it's really, can you get through the first 5 years? They generally say that you don't start making a return on investment until year five. So for those young farmers that are bravely giving it a go now and getting by every year, I think that they're actually doing well, and I think that there is potential for them to make a better living as they continue to grow the market for their product. It's a labor of love. You really got to love it to get into it.
Yeah. Well, thanks so much, Sarah. And if people are more interested if you're a young person interested in farming, you can go to your website.
Yeah, check us out. We've got a great new website, youngagrarians.org.
Yeah.
And we're all over social media, so
Yeah, and it's a great website with a lot of information and some really inspiring videos as well. I found so. Thanks so much, Sarah.
Thank you.
And that was Sarah Dent with the group Young Agrarians, interviewed by Jane Bowie. Well, it's now 11:41. You're listening to Democracy North. And be back with Dr. Kent Mullinek, Director of Sustainable Agriculture and Food Security at Kwantlen Polytechnic University. He's discussing the threats to farmland and why farming is so important to the future of humanity. You're listening to Democracy North, a cross-Canada independent news and culture hour here on Vancouver Co-op Radio, as well as on the Rabble Podcast Network and on iTunes. CFRO 100.5 FM. I'm David Ball, your host and curator for this week. Well, our host Jane Bowie interviewed Dr. Kent Mullinex as part of her ongoing series looking into agriculture. He's the Director of Sustainable Agriculture and Food Security at Kwantlen Polytechnic University.
The Agricultural Land Reserve was established in 1973 to end the rapid loss of agricultural land. Has the ALR been successful?
Oh, yes, Jane, I think it has been successful, not at a 100% level, but for the most part, very successful. In recent years, municipalities that have made a concerted effort to curtail ALR land loss, the legislation has been very successful.
Yeah, I read some of what you said about what some of the steps Surrey has taken, for example, to curb some of that land loss. Can you explain some of that?
Yeah, Surrey adopted a policy that for every 1 acre of ALR land that was petitioned to be removed from the ALR, 2 acres had to be put in within Surrey. Mm-hmm. So they have what they call the two-for-one policy. Mm-hmm. And it has, since they instituted the two-for-one policy, it has essentially precluded any ALR removal.
One of the things that in my conversations with Harold Steeves that he was pointing to and I mentioned in my introduction is that there still is, despite what you just said, that there's an expectation that lands will be taken out of the ALR if speculators just wait. Your thoughts on that?
Oh, I think that's absolutely true. In our work in Surrey, we interviewed a number of realtors. We were looking at all of the underutilized ALR parcels in Surrey to assess their potential to contribute to a local regional food system. And we saw a lot of for sale signs on ALR land. Mm-hmm. And knowing full well that it was valued well beyond anything that agriculture could service, we talked to realtors and representatives for those lands. And without exception, they all said that the land was not valued for agriculture, but was valued for development. And in fact, one realtor conveyed to us that there really wasn't any ALR land within the borders of the municipality of Surrey that was bought or sold for agriculture.
I want to talk more sort of some specifics around crops, etc., that we grow in the Lower Mainland. What we could do to improve that situation, but maybe you could talk a little bit about exactly why, in the big picture, farming is so important to continue in the Lower Mainland.
Well, from my perspective, Jane, there's some very pragmatic aspects to this, and some less pragmatic, but certainly with the advent of climate change and our uncertainty of what will be able to be grown where, and it's tremendous uncertainty. Arable land in temperate climates is going to become an increasingly valuable asset. The advent of peak oil is going to preclude the largesse of the transnational agri-food system. Again, the capacity for regional food production is going to become increasingly important, not just from a food provision standpoint, mm-hmm. but from an economic standpoint. And I think it's important that everyone know that good agricultural soils in good agricultural areas developed over millennia, literally developed over millennia, they are irreplaceable. And so for all practical purposes, we're obligated to see agricultural soils as a non-renewable resource. And right now we exploit them as if they are renewable, but mm-hmm. they're not. All of this is exacerbated by incredible population growth and urban encroachment, incredible increase in animal production that results in the desertification of agriculture land, tremendous increase in the salinization globally of arable lands, and tremendous soil erosion and hence loss of arable lands. So all of the cards in the deck are stacking up against land-based production mm-hmm. agriculture, which is what's going to feed the world, mm-hmm. and everybody knows it. And so agriculture land absolutely is, in addition to fresh water, the most precious natural resource we have, and the most and again, along with fresh water, the most indispensable. But the other reason, from my perspective as an agriculturist and one who thinks about the relationship of agriculture to society, is that how we get our daily sustenance, how we get our food, how we produce our food, our relationship with our food speaks more about our humanity on a day in and day out basis than almost any aspect of the human enterprise. Mm-hmm. And we have to have, I believe, a healthy, appropriate relationship with Mother Earth through our food system, and caring for the land, tending, caring for arable land, maintaining our ability to have this relationship, direct relationship as a individual, as a community, as a society, is fundamentally important to the expression of an appropriate humanity, I believe.
That's beautifully put. I heartily agree with you. And I, one of the things that heartens me about the situation is that while there are these pressures that you've outlined so clearly endanger and threaten farmland very acutely, there's also a growing recognition of exactly what you've just outlined, of why it's so important to protect that farmland. I don't think I've heard the level of discussion around this issue as much as I have in the last couple years. So do you, and the fact that you have the program that you have at Kwantlen, I think reflects that shift in people's thinking.
Well, I think you're absolutely right, Jane, tremendous and growing awareness that the way we've organized the human economy, and I mean our way of being, generating wealth jobs and all mm-hmm. everything else, it simply isn't sustainable, and everybody's beginning to understand this, but I think more importantly, everybody's beginning to feel it at a very visceral level, mm-hmm. and so we've got to rethink and reorganize how we go about our lives.
So in the in the sort of short term and local local way of thinking, what solutions are you suggesting would help protect the existing farmland and make it more accessible for farmers and make that land land that would be growing crops that would better address food security issues?
Super good question. There's a number of things that I think need to be done, and a number of things that we're trying to contribute to. One is we can protect the farmland till the cows come home, but that does not create a viable, economically and ecologically viable agriculture. So we have got to look at federal and provincial and local economic and planning policies and regulations that promote a regional food system. Mm-hmm. And so we're working on that. We are in the process right now of designing and planning for a Southwest BC bioregional food system, and we're doing the same thing in the Yukon. And our vision is not a global food system, but a global network of regional food systems. Mm-hmm. And so in that, I think we also have to begin to delineate what the economic job creation and small and medium-sized business creation potential is for regionalized agriculture. Mm-hmm. And understand that there's tremendous amount of income generation and job creation potential in the regionalization of our food system, but it's going to take economic policy mm-hmm. to support it. Mm-hmm. And we've got to realize that our economic system and vis-a-vis our food system absolutely is a construct or a manifestation of our economic policies and strategies.
And that was Dr. Kent Mullinex. He teaches at Kwantlen College and was interviewed by Jane Bowie. Well, that's our show for this week. You've been listening to Democracy North here on Vancouver Co-op Radio, CFRO 100.5, as well as on iTunes and the Rabble Podcast Network. And you can find us also at CHLY Radio in Nanaimo, as well as here on this station at 11 o'clock every Thursday. I've been David Ball. Thank you so much for listening today.
Every weekday from 7 to 8 a.m., Media Mornings brings you independent news and culture you won't hear anywhere else.
Daily headlines, interviews, countless local voices, and our Latin America report help you make sense of today's news, from Coast Salish territories to global affairs.
Guests include David Suzuki.
Media become hostages of the corporate agenda, and thank God for the independent like you.
Indigenous activists like Pam Palmater.
This kind of radio show helps inform Indigenous and non-Indigenous people and hopefully inspire our Indigenous citizens to take action.
Social justice advocates like Maude Barlow.
We are continue to be America's gas tank, although now we want to be the gas tank for the world.
Artists like Kenny Starr.
The landscape of change is created by lots of different types of activists.
Ray Spoon.
Gender is limiting and affecting everyone.
And authors like Michael Parenti.
The state is at the service of these corporations.
So tune in to Media Mornings, weekdays 7 to 8 a.m.
and podcasting at w2media.ca.